so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
Welcome to part two, my conversation with Martin Wolf on his forthcoming book on the relationship between capitalism and governance. In this episode, we focus on the kind of reforms, modifications, and innovations that would be necessary to restore faith in society and the prospect of a sustainable future.
Yeah, and I mentioned Peter Temin moments ago. Temin's most recent book is about the history of the failure of attempts to reduce racial inequality. The working title is Never Together. And he talks in great depth about the work surrounding Roosevelt and surrounding President Truman, and how things were undermined, how the courts became a vehicle for inhibiting or setting back attempts. And now, as you, I'm sure, are well aware, the vitality and weaponization and military approach to law enforcement, weaponized law enforcement, and the prison industrial system have, which you might call, become even more harsh. And yet in this polarized identity politics, there are people who affirm that as though that's what you might call the essence of their safety. I once wrote a piece I called Beyond the Haunted House, when I was referring to being a child and Martin Luther King came and spoke at my high school, where I was 11 at the time, and my mother had voted to support that be allowed, and people were attacking her. And what I said was, to me, the haunted house is when you're a human being and otherness is present, and it starts to seep into your conscious that maybe the thing that's called an other may change. And instead of being, as I was, a privileged white suburban kid, the world might shift, and then I'm an other. And without that, what you might call cohesive human agenda, system, design that unifies us around a republic, we all, which you might call, devolve into anxiety and fear and polarization. And I think the haunted house is very, very profound in the United States right now.
If you look at this is the most extreme example of a breakdown that I sort of looked at, and it's slightly different, but if you look at what happened in Yugoslavia in the early 90s, these are Serbs, Croats, Bosnians had all lived side by side perfectly peacefully. And they weren't, in most cases, I've talked to people, particularly aware of the ethnicity of their neighbors. The state was strong. There wasn't any real reason to think about this too much. And this can basically change in a week or a day. And it can certainly change easily over a few years. All you need to do is to discover that there are people out there who are attacking people like you. And the only people who will defend you because the state is weak or gone or indifferent or on the other side are people like you. So you start clustering very, very quickly into groups of people like you, and you try and get arms because there's nothing else. And you start attacking people like them before they attack you, because you know if you don't, they're going to attack you. And so people like them immediately say, well, the only people who are safe to be with are people like us. And in a very, very short time, in villages in Croatia, for example, Serbs and Croats were killing, who had lived side by side, were killing one another. It is, and of course, when you think about it, it's perfectly obvious. The first requirement for human beings is security, basic security. That's not an illusion, it's basic. The state exists to provide that. It has to do it in a neutral, just, compelling, legitimate way. That's what it's there for. Now, let's suppose the state doesn't do that, or looks as though it won't do it. Let's suppose the state says, insanely in my view, actually all of you can have as many guns as you like, and you can provide your own security. And it will help you by, as you've described in this case, to the dominant group, we'll have, you know, I have a line on this, which is America. This is from a British point of view, because here we really are different. My view is America doesn't have a police forces. It has occupying armies. And it's perfectly obvious if you walk around the streets of America that they're occupying armies. They're just not threatening to old white people like me, but it's obvious. Now, in this society, in such a society, awareness of who you are you under threat or not? Is someone a threat or not? Becomes absolutely pervasive. And I think America's actually got quite a long way towards that, particularly under Trump, because that's what Trump is about. Interestingly, of course, 30 years ago, now partly because of the policies you describe, which were completely unacceptable, things seemed to be calming down. You could imagine people going in a more sane direction. But I think the core problem in the US is that elites aren't interested in resolving these deep social tensions. They're interested in having these deep social tensions because the only way they can divide people sufficiently successfully to ensure that no policy will ever be mounted effectively to change the incredible economic and social privileges of the plutocracy. And that's their aim. It's as simple as that. And as long as that's their aim and they're successful by pursuing these policies and people are what people are, angry, frightened, looking for salvation.
Well, when you look at Donald Trump's campaign in 2015, 2016, the kind of bumper sticker was the system is rigged. And he mowed down. He appealed to the despairing.
Yeah.
And without identity politics, I guess what I would say is there were a lot of white working class people who had been part of the New Deal to Lyndon Johnson coalition who felt abandoned in the era of globalization, mm-hmm. automation, and the like. And he's running around, beats all the Republicans, and then defeats Hillary Clinton in the presidential election. And while perhaps his diagnosis conveyed a sense that we would get a president who was truthful about the dysfunction, the remedies he's prescribed exacerbated them, and it's led him to resorting to a more intensified identity politics, essentially to maintain the loyalty of those who voted for him, who he abandoned in terms of economics and the economic conditions that needed to change. And I look now, we've just seen a movie here in America on Netflix called The Social Dilemma. And part of the film is about the use of the internet and what my old friend Eli Pariser called the filter bubble, which is when you go on and they have an advertising model, they study you and then only give you the subset of information that reinforces your beliefs. And that, in essence, the film is talking about how, in a combination of what I'll call surveillance state and this polarizing, that the internet systems, the big web companies, are alleged to be contributing to the onset of a civil war. They exacerbate the polarizations you've been describing.
I'm sure that's true. One of the suggestions I have, not all this assumes, of course, benevolent politics might happen in some European countries, is that the algorithms of all major social media company should be matters of public record and public regulation. And the how they work, that means, of course, giving the state, you have to believe in a regulatory state, of course, the state, the resources to understand the implications of these algorithms, to change them when necessary, because these are matters of social interest. They're matters of public interest. They're not matters of purely private concern. That seems to be about as obvious as anything. It's pretty clear that among the other things that we haven't discussed, that we are, you know, in multiple dimensions, in the middle of a very, very substantial technological revolution in the computing stroke AI stroke communications area. And the if you look back on the history of humanity, major transformations in transport and communications are devastating. So probably the most devastating combination in the last 1,000 years was the almost simultaneous development of printing and the long distance floating battleship, which allowed the complete transformation of European religion, the complete transformation of European communication, of science, of political thought, both good and bad. And of course, simultaneously with the other thing, allowed all this to be spread across the whole world with extraordinarily virulent consequences, essentially everywhere, as Europeans basically seized the world. Their control over gunpowder went with this. The ability to turn a ship into a floating battleship was rather remarkable. So here we are now. We have a colossal transformation.
The fascinating thing in this film on the social dilemma was the notion that, how would I say this, that it is almost like, because of the sheer scale and the possibilities associated with scale to have enormous influence, that a curse was descending upon mankind. And I've been listening at webinars to one of INET's partners, the Center for International Governance Innovation. Both Rohinton Medora, who runs that, and Jim Balsillie, who founded it, are talking about these profound transformations of society. And as Rohinton says, why do we have a Food and Drug Administration where we check out and test things and show that they're okay or at least safe and have some positive benefits before they're released? But what we let is technology go out and tear up society, and then we fight it back. We need to have a governance system related to what technical change is, how would you say, beneficial to that human social system. I don't know how we get there.
That's very difficult, because at least with a drug, you can persuade people pretty easily. If this is a bad drug, it's going to do terribly obvious things to you, like kill you. So a big thing was thalidomide. You know, that really sort of people, yeah, no, you really don't want to let this happen. The problem with the social media is the effects of clearly very, I was trying to suggest with my analogy to the past, the effects are unbelievably deep and profound, but they're incredibly difficult to sort of measure precisely and make personal. You know, okay, Facebook is a disaster, doing all sorts of crazy things, but how does it affect me? I think people don't feel it that way, and that's part of the problem.
Let me shift to a direction. I know both you and I held the late Paul Volcker in very high regard, and I spent a lot of time with him in the last years of his life, and he was very close. He was a supporter of INET among other things. And we did a lot of work with the Volcker Alliance. And Paul was very concerned about what you might call the abuse of the notion of central bank independence, and that central bank participation in bailouts that did not have what you might call penalizing consequences for managements or stockholders or what have you would destroy the trust or faith in that expertise, and that independence would be rescinded. I know in some of your writing that you've shared with me about the COVID crisis that we've seen what was already a very unequal society, and then we saw the bailouts take place and what you might call fortified not only the tech companies we were just talking about, but fortified all of the what I call private equity, highly leveraged companies that were almost, how would I say, reckless in the extent to which they did not maintain a safety cushion. And I made a podcast the other night with Dennis Kelleher, who runs Better Markets in Washington. He's a very profoundly experienced lawyer and Senate staff. And he was saying, we're going to need a Department of Economic Security to take care of Main Street because the central bank has morphed into something that no longer is attentive to the general economy. And the cynicism, the despondency that you and I have been talking about, the two paths that this bailout may inspire when people calm down and look back at it, it could be very damaging to the credibility of American or governance in other countries. At the same time, standing by and watching and doing nothing doesn't make any sense at all. That's just watching things disintegrate. How do you see the role the central banks have played in light of Paul Volcker's concerns, in light of the distributional consequences that we've experienced in the first year of these actions and bailouts?
I think it has to be put in this longer term context. And my inclination is to feel that it's not really, well, okay, I'm going to be bold. It's not really the fault of central banks. So let's go back to the really important question in this regard, which is why Paul Volcker ceased to be Fed chair in 87. I think it was 87, wasn't it?
Yeah,
86, sorry. So everybody knew that Paul was very hawkish about regulation of the financial system. And he's never changed his view that basically these people can't be trusted. And it has to be said, this is consistent with experience. I was not so clear about this 35 years ago, but it became obvious in the course of the late 90s, to me, with the Asian financial crisis more than anything. Now, he was got rid of. I can't remember now whether he wanted to stay on. I think he would have been prepared to. He was still relatively young. But he was replaced by Alan Greenspan. Now, that wasn't an accident. It was what political forces, of course, the financial system, wanted. So now you could say Greenspan then encouraged the ideology that it'll all be fine. Perfectly true. But my suggestion is if it hadn't been Greenspan, it had been somebody else. The political forces and social forces of that time, and this went on well into the 2000s under both parties, and I wasn't fantastically hostile at the time, should have been, liked the deregulation. They liked the additional debt and credit. It looked like a free lunch. And now, in that political context, I'm suggesting that if the central bank had got up, you know, there had been a Volcker president, chairman, he'd have been sacked, as Reagan sacked Volcker, or as the Reagan administration did not renew him. So there was a period, a long period, when we believed that the expansion of the financial sector was an unambiguous good. I'm not saying everybody did. I'm sure you were wiser, but a lot of people did. Now, you've done that. Then along comes all sorts of shocks, which I've written about in my book on the crisis, which made it, and I argue that the China shock is a big part of that, really necessary to stimulate the economy in the early 2000s, when it was already clear after the stock market bubble had gone, that it was really hard to do this. And the financial sector was the obvious lever, and the central bank's job was to keep the economy going, so they let it rip. So by the time the crisis came, that we had a hugely over-leveraged economy, a hugely over-expanded financial sector, and all the fragility and vulnerability of it, as a result of, I think, essentially a political process at which central banks were a part, but I don't think the decisive part. I know this is not universally accepted. What could they have done throughout? Could they have run, they could have said, well, we're going to run a very tight monetary policy which doesn't allow credit to expand. They would have been sacked. They would all have been sacked. Greenspan was loved because that's not what he did. So now when you get hit by a financial crisis like that, what can you do? I argued in the crisis that it would have been sensible to nationalize all the major companies they bailed out. It was probably being politically impossible. It would certainly have led to a war with Wall Street. The politicians at that time weren't up for it. Obama wasn't up for it. And maybe they should have, but they weren't. They wanted the system to go back to the way it was before. Well, that didn't work out too well. But essentially what they then said, this is all relevant to COVID-19. Okay, we'll freeze that debt. It'll go down a bit. The government will increase its debt. And it turned out the non-financial corporate sector would increase its debt. And now it wasn't in the banking sector. It was somewhere else. So the central banks weren't even directly responsible for it. They're not responsible for bonds markets going crazy and lending to private equity or Brazilian finance, or whatever it is. The whole slew of additional debt was accumulated in the non-financial corporate sectors of the world between the financial crisis and COVID-19. That was very remote from the central banks. And now they hit again, and they have to save the markets again, which they've done. And now they start saving these wider markets. Obviously, that's part of what they do. And the governments go along, because what's the alternative? We're already in the deepest depression since the 1930s. So I tend to the view that the central banks themselves are part of a very deep societal process, which evolved from the 70s, 80s, which at a social level ignored the risks, which of course previous generations had learned from exploding finance. Socially, they'd forgotten. They weren't aware of it in the way someone had gone through the 30s was aware of it. They loved the benefits of this. Everybody loved it, particularly, of course, at the top, where immense wealth was accumulated, which had tremendous political power associated with it, a subject you know very, very well, which people got elected supporting all this. And ordinary people didn't mind being able to borrow and make money out of housing or buying stocks or whatever it would be. And this sort of process, like all human processes of this kind, seemed to go on until they just blow up, like Graham Allison's view of the Thucydides trap. You have an arms race till in the end it blows up. So central banks, to me, I'm afraid, and this is not the view I held 20 years ago or even during the financial crisis, but it's been since then, are just part of this incredibly powerful social and political process for the fun of creating a very vulnerable, fragile economy. I have written now pieces on how you get out of this, given where we are now. And the answer is, it's hard. I mean, it's really hard given how overextended the balance sheets of our entire economic systems are. Essentially, we need zero interest rates forever, difficult to guarantee. We need enormous discipline over additional debt. And we need the government to take on a role as spender and possibly using partly using the monetary system directly, which I've been argued for, partly borrowing a mixture, so that instead of relying on private sector debt, credit, and all these disruptions, we actually rely on government to do a lot of it. And that, I think, is where we now are. But part of the politics we've been talking about is that the politicians who have argued for a much bigger role for government, government investment, government spending on all the things like education, they run into the simple problem that ordinary people don't trust the government. There's a trust breakdown that doesn't allow them to allow the people who believe in this to get elected. And in truth, most of the people who believe in this are pretty flaky. So anyway, I know this is a very long, not very disciplined answer on central banks. I think the problem is much deeper. It's an important part of what I argued in my book on the crisis. But of course, if we could have had something like Paul Volcker in charge of the Fed for the last 40 years, with his view of markets, and that view had been accepted, and he was allowed to do it, we will be in much better shape today. That's right.
Well, what I refer to as the commodification of social design in the United States, where the role of money politics has, allowed the sector to dominate the architecture, supervision, regulation, enforcement, appointments of that sector. It's fostered what some call the mother of all moral hazards. What Volcker would have argued is that having the ability to bail out has to be accompanied by what you might call the prior restraint of risk-taking. At a very simple level, somebody like Ed Cain writes beautiful work about how too-big-to-fail banks do not have a default risk premium, so they have a funding cost advantage, and they gain market share, and they take excessive risk. And I'll just go back to an anecdote. At the time, Paul Volcker, he helped me get my job with Pete Domenici and the Senate Budget Committee, Republican from New Mexico. And at the time that Volcker's reappointment came up, the Republican leaders, people like Howard Baker, James Baker, Domenici, Bob Dole, and others were meeting. And what they were talking about was that the Glass-Steagall Act allowed the investment bankers to maintain a protection and profitability, and they were donors to the Democratic Party that was enforcing it, whereas the commercial banks were donors to the Republican Party. And the removal of Volcker is because he was with a Republican administration, but interested in a public policy that maintained something like the Glass-Steagall Act and didn't deregulate to the detriment of not only the commercial banks, but to the detriment of the fundraising race for Republicans versus Democrats. And Greenspan, of a different philosophy, was more amenable to things that fortified the Republican coalition. So that money politics was present in 1986, and it continued to blossom. And what concerns me about the commodification of social design is as people accumulate wealth, they become more powerful. So you have an amplifying feedback loop, which leads to excesses and distortions of representation for the narrow, powerful few to the detriment of the many.
Yeah, I sort of feel I have no idea how one fixes all that. Absolutely none. And I think it's gone further in the US on multiple dimensions. So I think you have bigger problems. But of course, the rest of the world, particularly the democratic world, is so deeply integrated into the American economic and particularly financial system that it really can't separate itself at all. And also it has its own quite big problems with the financial sector. I know this personally because I was involved in discussing transformations of the British banking sector after the financial crisis. I was in a government created commission which made some quite important proposals, which sort of introduced a semi-Glass-Steagall into Britain. I think something pretty close to the Glass-Steagall. But in doing it, we were all told by our government, quite understandably in a way, we couldn't do anything that would make it impossible for us, for our banking sector to remain competitive in the world. And so that we meant we were constrained by what the Americans would do. So America, of course, does spread the whole, its system spread across the world. I mean, American regulation has in, you know, this is a the point I was trying to suggest, what I think of as the macro forces problem. I mean, my perception is that American banking, qua banking, is in a significantly better place now than it was 15 years ago. Which doesn't mean, of course, it's invulnerable to the complete collapse of the economy. It's obvious if there's a complete collapse of the economy and mass bankruptcy, the banking system will be destabilized, to put it mildly, if not destroyed. But the problem is that the economy is given the structure of the economy internationally and domestically. The economy is dependent on a very large amount of, if you like, irresponsible consumption, unaffordable consumption, unsustainable consumption. The only way that can be obtained is by encouraging somewhere in the system huge expansions of debt and credit. So you can close down the banking channel, but it can still occur somewhere else. And it has occurred somewhere else. Not in a dreadfully inefficient way. And as I said, what has become obvious to me, and was obvious even to me during my writings on the financial crisis, is that, so the Aminsky point, that if you've got this sort of fundamental vulnerability, the only borrower the only institution that can spend to stabilize the economy when nobody else can do so soundly is the state. And the state remains largely neutered from being an effective spender. It's a crisis spender as it is now, that's fine. But it's not an effective long-term spender because we've not allowed it to be. And as long as it's not allowed to be an effective long-term spender, the debt credit bubble in the private sector is going to emerge somewhere. But I agree with you, of course, lobbying affects all this in a very, very way.
A captured or refracted spender rather than a socially representative spender. And that feeds the kind of despondency that brings you back to the pathway towards the demagogue and despair.
Yeah, you need a political miracle to shift this, or an economic miracle, something that comes along which just resolves the growth problem and is naturally, you know. Part of what was good about the 50s and 60s is that the growth of that time was, I think, naturally equalizing, or at least not disequalizing. Pretty well, I'm not suggesting for a moment, by the way, that this is not the consequence of policy, but pretty well everything that's been coming along in the last 30 years, 40 years, has tended to make problems of equality worse. I think that's true on multiple dimensions. So to deal with that, governments have to act very, very powerfully against it. And to act very powerfully against it, against very powerful economic forces of the kind we've been discussing, globalization is part of it. The technology is part of it, very big part of it. The shift towards more educated people away from the collapse of deindustrialization, which was a natural process in large part. Given that, you needed very, very active and assertive government to offset it. And some of the Scandinavians did do that, but you know, most of our countries weren't prepared for that sort of government. They'd never thought of having that sort of government in normal times. And of course, now it's even more difficult than it was then, 20, 30, 40 years ago. So we do need to recreate not just an effective state, we need to recreate an effective, legitimate state which people believe in at just the point when there's the least possible belief in it.
Well, Martin, I think I'm going to have to ask you, as your book comes together, to come back and talk to me again. But I want to thank you for today, because you have looked in the eye at these tremendous challenges. You've studied deeply the history of political ideas and the history of institutions, and over the last few months you've been sharing with me a lot of this perspective. But you're really going to the heart of the matter, and you're, in my view, courageously not blinking and illuminating many of the challenges that we face. And while someone listening to this conversation could find it quite bleak, I think an accurate diagnosis is the precursor to having an effective remedy. And while we may not see it, or we may not put a high probability on it, you got to start with understanding the problems and understanding where the breakdown came from. And I think you've done a marvelous job, and I want to thank you for sharing it with our audience today.
I thank you very much. It's been very enjoyable, rather lengthy. I wish I were more optimistic, but I do agree with you. If we don't understand or try to understand the problem, we can't possibly find solutions. And the worst thing we can do is to believe, you know, that if Mr. Trump is defeated and goes away, yeah, this is all solved.
Yep. Well, how would I say, romantic delusion is not part of a solution. And you've kept a wonderful and courageous focus on these issues. And I think that's a tremendous gift, because also from your place at the Financial Times, you have a very large audience, and the challenge will be taken seriously. But I think we should sign off for today, and thank you. I will be asking you to come back at the time when your book is approaching release. But thank you.
Great pleasure. Goodbye, Bob. Bye-bye. Rob.
And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing.